How many of you have been just so blessed and overjoyed and uplifted from this look at the book of Judges? Couple, three. I haven't been. It is such a dark book. It is such a how many of you have been challenged in your own life from what you've been seeing in theirs? A few more hands. How many of you want to finish up the book? Move on to something more uplifting, right? Yes. Yeah. If I could get away with it, I would. Yeah, I've not been looking forward to this sermon for several weeks now. The author of the book of Judges concludes the book with two summaries, one we looked at last week. Both of these summaries drive home his point. Not lessons from the life of the judges, but rather why the judges were needed, why the Lord chose to discipline the nation with persecution from the tribes, the people groups around them. Joshua, last week, and the leaders of the generation had passed away, and immediately a generation comes up that does not know the Lord and does not know what the Lord has done for Israel. Early, we see the synopsis from last week, early in the time of that 350-year time of Judges, way early on, we see a mother and her son, a family unit. We see a Levite, you know, a consecrated man. And we see a clan, if not a majority, of the tribe of Dan. All sin. They're all falling. They're all stumbling over themselves in sin. And not just that, but they're strategizing their sin. They're figuring out how to sin. They're planning their sin. And not just that, when they're sinning, they're excusing their sin. And what struck me most, as I told you, was not their ignorance of God's precepts, God's standards, not their selfishness, their self-serving, self-gratifying pursuits, but rather that they believe, all three of them, the family, the Levite, the clan, they all believe that God is leading them, blessing them, making all of this available, giving them opportunity, sanctioning their actions. That troubled me, because their story is our story. What kept coming up as Joanna and I were reading through that passage and doing research was that one verse. It says, "The heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Who can know it?" Our hearts, my dear friends, our hearts can convince our minds that God has made available, God has sanctioned, God has blessed, given us opportunity for our self-serving, self-satisfying pursuits. Our hearts can convince our minds that God has made available, blessed, given us opportunity for our sinful pursuits. Before we look at today's synopsis, can you see I'm trying to put this off a little bit? There are three things that I want you to know before we get into it. First, last week's synopsis should be shocking or confrontational to your mind, to your thoughts. It's so obvious that these people's lives are incongruent with the will of God, the Word of God, that it's hard to comprehend. This week's synopsis should be not just shocking to your mind, but shocking to your heart. The immorality and the vulgarity is offensive to even read this chapter, this story. These two chapters should be rated R. Even in their depictions, maybe X. And while leftists were fighting to have the Bible banned in public libraries, they were using this chapter, these two chapters, this story, as one of their reasons to keep it out of the hands of children. I'm going to purposefully be as vague as possible this morning, considering our mixed audience of age range and both genders. Second, a lot of people, as they read through this last final synopsis, look at a Levite, and they focus on the Levite that he had a concubine. And I don't really think that that is the focal point of this story. Without going into all the theological precepts, it's very obvious, overly apparent, that God has intended marriage to be between one man and one woman from the garden, from Genesis all the way through Paul teaching the Ephesians about marriage. Old Testament to New Testament. And particularly as we come to the New Testament, we see the Bible, we see Jesus Christ lift, raise the status of females and the wife, and seriously establish the precept of a covenant marriage between one man and one woman. Now, here's our dilemma. While the Old Testament never, certainly never, approves of multiple wives, doesn't sanction them, it also does not condemn them. That's why I don't think that this is the focal point of our story. So let me give you a definition of a concubine and then tell you why it was culturally, what word did I just say? Culturally accepted in the Old Testament times. First, a concubine is a wife in a legally recognized marriage. She is a legal wife. But the marriage to this second wife or third wife was considered second class. It was not premier. It was not raised up. And while she would be provided by the husband food and clothing, he wouldn't provide her shelter. She would typically stay at home with her family. She would not live with her husband. Her children were recognized as legitimate children, not illegitimate, but legitimate. However, they did not have automatic inheritance rights. Inheritance rights were first given opportunity from the first wife, the premier wife, the primary wife. From what we understand, this particular relationship, a husband and his second wife, came about for the purposes of providing an heir if the first wife was unable to have children, or solidifying family business, even tribal or national alliances, agreements, or, and this is what I think might be relevant to today's story, preventing an impoverished girl, a girl who is born into poverty, into a low, low family, who had no rights in that culture, none in that time. She had no rights, preventing her from being sold into slavery or becoming a prostitute. So that was what was going on culturally as far as having a concubine, a second wife, and why I don't think it was necessarily the focal point of this story. Third, we believe the synopsis is to be taking place very early again in the time of Judges. And I think the idea is, look how fast this happens. Look how fast this happens after Moses and then after Joshua. Look how fast a society, a culture, a family, a clan, a tribe can descend. How quickly. The name Phinehas that we see in this story is Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron. Now consider this. Moses and Aaron die before the people enter the land. And then Joshua and Aaron's son, Eleazar, die just after the land has been apportioned to the 12 tribes, and then you have Eleazar's son, Phinehas. So this is very early in the time frame of the Judges. And I think it's relevant and important to remember who Phinehas is. How many of you remember Phinehas? Boy, I've got my Moody students here in their Old Testament. Man, their Old Testament summary. Phineas in the desert. It's great. Okay? While they're in the desert, the Israelites join the Moabites in worship of Baal. There you go. I knew you would get it. God is enraged. Think about this. How far are they out of Egypt? What have they seen the Lord do for them? And now they're worshiping Baal. So he sends a plague. And the plague is just ripping up Israel. People are dying left and right. Moses, at God's command, has all the leaders of this rebellious worship, all the leaders totally executed. And then the people are gathering themselves at the tabernacle and they're weeping and mourning the plague. The leaders are dead. They were executed. 24,000 Israelites are dying from this plague or have died from this plague. And they're weeping and mourning. Now, at the tabernacle, an Israelite man approaches the tabernacle with his foreign wife. And Phineas is just outraged. How dare he? Doesn't he know what's going on and why it's going on? So Phineas jumps up, and this Israelite man and his foreign wife kind of look at Phineas and they take off running. And Phineas chases them all the way to their tent. And along the way, he grabs a spear. He goes into the tent and boom, boom, and they're both dead. He runs them through with the spear. Now, listen to what God says, because the plague stops right then. Listen to what God says. Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron the priest, has turned away my wrath from the sons of Israel, in that he was jealous with my jealousy among them, so that I did not destroy the sons of Israel in my jealousy. Therefore, behold, I give him my covenant of peace. And it shall be for him and his descendants after him a covenant of perpetual priesthood, because he was jealous for his God and made atonement for the sons of Israel. That is who Phinehas was. I think it's important to remember who Phinehas was and how he felt about the Lord and how the Lord felt about Phinehas, and see him, see his placement in this story. As we jump toward the synopsis, I usually try to have some sort of illustration from modern life or from my life, some sort of little story to make you laugh or to make you think, right? And I was telling Joanna, I don't have one. I can't think of anything last week or this week, like what to say. You know, when we had Samson, I told you about reading the Samson, seeing the picture when I was a little kid. I've got nothing to say, and Joanna says, good. Joanna's like, if you have a story that's relevant to these last two synopses, we have a problem. So I have no story, no illustration. We are going to let the synopsis, the paraphrase of the synopsis, be its own illustration. And we begin with one of our bookend verses. It says, in those days, there was no king in Israel. And again, I don't believe that this means, unfortunately, we have no king. If only we just had a king. God is to rule over them. They are to obey his word, to obey his commandments. He will protect and he will provide for them. He rules from the tabernacle and through the priests to the people. And it is the Levites who are to provide social structure. It's the Levites who are to provide social structure. They are to bring assistance to the priests. They are to bring order to the nation. They assist in all those tabernacle duties, the ministry of the tabernacle. They are to communicate, it says, blessing from the Lord to the people. That's their job. Bring the Lord's word to the people. They are to settle. Think about this in relevance to the story. It is the Levites who are to settle disputes among the people, and it's the Levites who are to determine damages that are to be paid, compensation for damages. But we start here with this verse. There's no structure. There's nothing going on. I think Samuel wrote this book, and he's looking backwards saying, at that time, there was no king in Israel. In those days, there was no king. There's no structure. Everything's out of order. The order that God put in place is gone. There's nothing going on. People are not doing what they're supposed to be doing. It's no coincidence. Therefore, that last week's synopsis and this week's synopsis involves a misplaced Levite. A Levite who is not where he is supposed to be. A Levite who is not doing what he is supposed to be doing. If you get into a little bit of the word study in these verses, a little bit of the Hebrew, you come to understand that this Levite is not living in the Levitical town of his birth. He is out in a remote area accumulating wealth for himself, and he is marrying a second wife. And some of the father's language that we read later is a very common or very low language. So we can sort of deduce that she's from a poor family. And this is probably why he's married her. Now, it says that she's unfaithful and that she runs away and she goes back home. That could very well mean she has committed adultery. Or it's very possible that it means she has been unfaithful to him and has left him to return to her family. Both are unfaithful. Now, if she's committed adultery, what is this Levite supposed to do? Stone her. She's supposed to die. But we don't see him taking any of those actions. Now, that could be just because of his own fallenness, although later on you see he has no value for her life. What we do see him doing is trying to get her back, trying to get her to return home. So I don't think, just in my opinion, that she's committed adultery. I think she's just left him and gone home to her father. Okay? Now, her father should have sent her back to her husband immediately. He should have brought her back to uphold, to reaffirm, to reinforce the marriage covenant that has been agreed to. But after 4 months of waiting, she's not returning, so the Levite finally approaches the father-in-law. And the father-in-law welcomes him, and as is their custom, entertains the Levite for several days. It's customary in that culture. The Levite makes what seems like a half-hearted attempt to leave a couple times. I should be going. But the father-in-law persuades him to stay for another day, However, finally unwilling to stay any longer, the Levite decides to begin his travels back home with his wife late in the evening. It's not very safe to travel during the day at those times, let alone at night. As the day draws to a close, the Levite's servant wants to stop for the night in a town occupied by people from the land. But the Levite says, no, we need to go about what seems to be about 4 or 5 miles further to another town occupied by Israelites, our own people, people from the tribe of Benjamin. So they press on. They get to this little town. And they go to the central meeting place. And although they have all their own provisions, they don't need food or water or anything for their donkeys. They have all their own provisions. No one from the town offers them shelter for the night. Now, this is unheard of in that culture. The Levite's father-in-law, who entertained him and fed him and gave him drink for several days, that's customary. That's what they did. What's going on in this town is uncustomary, and it's a sign that something has broken down. There is a cultural or social breakdown in this town. Something's amiss. Something's awry. There's a problem. There's chaos in this town. Finally, an old man who happens to be from the same region that this Levite came from, seeming to understand that it is not safe for them to spend the night out in the open in the town square. Why wouldn't it be safe in the town square? These are guests. These are visitors. They should be safe. He offers them shelter in his own home. Now, during the night, some evil men from the town surround the home. They pound on the door and they demand that the Levite be brought out to them so that they could do great indecent harm to him. The old man pleads with them, "No, please, don't do this evil. Don't do this evil. Don't." They won't listen. They won't listen to this old man, supposed to be older, wiser, respected. So the Levite throws his wife out the door, the one he has just gone to great lengths to retrieve. And what does he do? While she's out there, he goes to bed. He goes to sleep for the night. They take her, and they do this horrible, indecent harm to her. And early in the morning, they let her go. They let her free. And she stumbles back to the house and collapses at the door with her hands on the threshold of the door, and she dies there. After a good night's sleep, the Levite gets up and prepares himself for his journey. He's going to go home. He's going to leave. He opens the door and he finds his wife laying on the ground. And he doesn't reach down to her and say, "Can I help you? What's wrong? What happened?" None of this. He says, "Get up. Let's go." Wow. "Get up. Let's go." Unconcerned with her welfare, unconcerned with her life, only concerned with himself and his agenda. See, seeing her run away from him was a slight to his pride, to his ego, to his status. When he realizes that she's dead, he picks up her body, puts it on his donkey, and with little more respect for her than the men of the town had, he butchers her body and sends a part of her body to each of the 12 tribes of Israel. And upon receiving it, all the people of Israel are in great distress. They are deeply troubled. They are asking themselves, "What's going on here? We've never seen anything like this happen ever before. Yes, there's been war. Yes, there's been wickedness. But this is over the top." And they're bothered. They're really bothered. So all the nation, from north to south, and that's what that little phrase means, from this town to this town, from north to south, and then from Gilead, east, from east to west, that means all the nation, everybody came from everywhere, assemble before the Lord. And the leaders of the tribes take their place in the assembly. And the nation's army is gathered with them. And there the Levite tells them his story. And the people are indignant, they're enraged, and they're angry, and they vow to punish that little town of Gibeah. And they vow that they will never let one of their daughters ever marry a Benjamite. So an army of how many soldiers? 400,000 soldiers. It's a lot. It's a lot. They go to the town, and they say to the town, surrounding the town, "Send out the men who did this." Not only will this town not send the men out, not only will this town protect those evil, vile, vulgar men, but all the towns of the tribe of Benjamin say, "Oh no, you are not going to treat us this way," and they come to the defense of the town. They gather 26,700 Benjamites to protect these detestable men, to protect this vile town from 400,000 Israelite soldiers. So do the math in your head. That's approximately 6%. 400,000 to 26,500. They are far, far outnumbered. With their vows made, with their armies gathered, with the ultimatum laid down to the town and basically to the tribe of Benjamin, they simply inquire of the Lord. Now think about this. They approach the Lord and say, which tribe should go first? Now, if you've paid attention, usually Judah is the first tribe to embark on a battle. Usually Judah is the one leading in procession. Usually Judah is the first to camp wherever they stop. So God simply says, Judah. It's kind of like, in my way of understanding this, of course, Judah. But the Benjamites defend the city and they kill 22,000 Israelites. They kill as many, almost as many Israelites as they have in their entire army for this city. So Israel gathers itself again and they cry over their loss and they cry over these 22,000 dead. And they ask the Lord, basically, this is what they're asking the Lord. Should we keep our vow or should we break our vow? Should we fight or should we stop? And the Lord says, basically, yes, you should keep your vow. You made a vow. But the Benjamites defend the city again. And this time they kill 18,000 Israelites. 400,000 Israelites gather, and we see 40,000 of them dead. Can anyone do the math? That's 10%. I know it's been a long time since high school. 10% of the Israeli army dies at the hands of people defending detestable men in a vile town. This time, the third time, not just the leaders and not just the soldiers, but the Bible says all the people of Israel gathered at the tabernacle. This time, they gather in humility. This time, they gather in true mourning and they fast. They deny themselves. This time, there is sacrifice. They present offerings before the Lord, and this time there is sacramental structure, an offering with the ministry of the high priest, this time Phinehas, when they inquire of the Lord. The Lord does not simply answer their question about their intentions. The Lord does not simply answer their questions about their strategies. This time the Lord says, I, you don't need 400,000. I will give them into your hands. This is my battle. So the Israelite soldiers draw the Benjamites out of this town. They draw them away from Gibeah. And while the Benjamites are out further away from the town, some other Israelite soldiers go into the town. They kill everybody. Everyone, everything, and they set the town on fire. And while the Benjamite soldiers are out in the field, they look back and they see that their stronghold, their place of defense, their strategic position has been leveled, laid waste to. The cloud is just way up. And they lose heart. They lose heart. And the Israelite army wipes them out. Save. With the exception of 600 soldiers from Benjamin who flee to the mountains, to the rocks, trying to hide, trying to just survive. And then the biblical principle of, if you remember this from our studies, devoted to destruction. begins. In fact, the words used to describe the evil men from the town of Gibeah who did this horrible act are the exact same words used in the law in Deuteronomy chapter 13 as it commands the destruction of an entire town when these type of men are found and these type of men have influence. And all the towns of Benjamin are devoted to destruction. Wiped out. It says every living thing. And as the dust settles from the battle, and as the Israelite army takes in all that they have purposed to do and have done, they realize that they have brought down one of the 12 tribes of Israel to virtual distinction. Excuse me. It's wrong. Extinction. Distinction. They were distinctly dead. Extinction. They are on the brink of annihilation. And they assemble before the Lord. And they weep and they mourn and they ask, get this. Have you ever done this in your life? Why has this happened? The consequences of my own actions. The consequences of my own strategies. The consequences of my own intention. Why, God, has this happened, they say. Why should one of the 12 tribes vanish? And without waiting for an answer, I think because they don't need one, they make another plan, which is what got them into trouble to begin with. They make another plan and they put it into action. They realize that there is one town from the tribe of Manasseh that had not assembled before the Lord and had not made a covenant to not allow their daughters to marry Benjamites. So they go to that town and half a tribe of Manasseh, and they find 400 young women who have not been married, and they give them to 400 of the 600 Benjamite soldiers, Benjamite survivors. And then they realize, well, there's still 200. There's still 200 that don't have wives. What are we going to do? Oh, we made this vow. And they think to themselves, So they tell these 200 soldiers, you know, if we sort of look the other way while you steal daughters from our tribes, it won't be as if we're breaking our vow to not give them to you. You just took them for yourselves. And that's what they do. They look the other way. 200 more women are stolen, and now each of the 600 surviving soldiers from this horrific time has a wife. And Benjamin barely survives. What a story. What a story to end a synopsis of 350 years. And how do you deal with what you're reading? How do you cope with what you're reading? As we conclude our study of the book of Judges, and we're going to come back next week and just recap it and just put it into one little package with a nice little bow on top. This week, I want you to consider three things as you walk through the week. Hopefully at least past lunchtime today. Number one. It's hard to overlook the disregard for sacramental duties and sacramental process in this story. It's hard to overlook the disregard for the sanctity of marriage and the sanctity of life. It's hard to overlook the disregard for purity, wholeness, to the extent that these people are willing to rally and champion and defend debauchery. Last week I correlated our first synopsis to the condition that we see in the church at large. This week, I correlate this synopsis to the condition of our culture. The culture in which we live. As shocking as it is to read this story, especially in regards to the men of the town of Gibeah and what they do, it does not hold a candle. It doesn't hold a candle to the culture in which we live. Not a candle. What's going on in the world around us, the complete, wanton disregard for the foundational principles of a moral society, to the extent that we are championing and defending and even celebrating utter debauchery, makes this synopsis look pale. Look pale by comparison. Some of you said to me this morning, I really want to see how you're going to handle these two chapters. And my rebuttal is, look outside. Look outside. Number two, a cursory reading of this synopsis might lead you to conclude that God let Israel lose 40,000 good soldiers in an obviously moral pursuit. But a careful reading of this synopsis details the ways in which these people, who have a just cause, maybe even a legal obligation, according to the law, draw their own conclusions, make their own vows, plan their own strategies, and worst of all, simply assume that the Lord approves of their moral indignation. What an assumption to make. What melodrama is devised to gather the assembly? Chop, chop, chop. What melodrama? What hasty and excessive vows are taken? We'll never. What overwhelming force is gathered to battle in their own strength? 20-1. Just to ask the Lord, which of us should go first? David or Peter? Just ask the Lord, which should start? When they finally deny themselves, when they have finally approached the Lord in humility, with offering in hand, sacrifice in hand, when they finally approach in proper consecrated process, he, in effect, tells them, I don't need your 400 soldiers. The battle is mine. Remember Sodom and Gomorrah? The detestable desires of that town, pillar of fire that leaves in its wake only charred pebbles. It's interesting, by the way, to look at the archaeological studies of those two tells. It's amazing. You've heard the phrase Sodom and Gomorrah, like Sodom and Gomorrah. This is like Sodom and Gomorrah. It's become a metaphor, right? Did you know that in the book of Hosea, a book in which God literally displays Israel's adultery toward him, this town, Gibeah, becomes the metaphor. As in the days of Gibeah. That's the phrase that God uses there, not Sodom and Gomorrah, as in the days of Gibeah. What would have happened if this Levite had approached the priests? The priests, the high priest. The high priest, the Lord. The assembly, listen to the Lord. Tell them what should be done. I just wonder if there would have been divine retribution. I don't know. Another pillar of fire from heaven, smoldering ashes and charred pebbles in Gibeah. Hail, boils, serpents. I don't know. Divine retribution. do you first. In humility and sacrifice, approach the Lord and inquire of Him His thoughts. Do you first, in humility, approach the Lord and inquire of Him His desire, His will, His plans? Or are you strategizing and planning and promising and then asking Him to bless and direct and guide what you have already contrived? And finally, number three, the near annihilation of one of the 12 tribes of Israel didn't just happen. Along with a few glaringly obvious errors, like, wow. Joanna said, what should the title of the message be? And by the way, we're always trying to do really provocative titles just to see who's paying attention, and no one ever approaches us about it. She said, what should the title of the message be? And I said, wow. Should it just be wow? Like, what? If we knew how to spell that, that would have been the title. Some glaring, obvious errors. But far more than that, there are these long series of these small steps. Little misguided decisions that brought them to this catastrophic moment. Think about it. Running away. Running away. The father not commending his daughter to keep her vow. Think about just those two things. We had our peacemaker series, and there's the fight and the flight responses, and they're both wrong. This running away thing. How many of you employ running away in your life? Running away from things you don't like. Running away from things that are hard. Running away from things that are scary. Or how about this? Go to the father's response to his daughter. She takes up residence in her home, in his home. And he's fine with that. Our kids or our family, do we stop and say, no. You need to do the right thing. You need to keep your commitments. You need to go back. You need to follow through on this. Or do we coddle each other? Do we coddle each other in our homes? Do we coddle each other in this church? So think about that. Running away, the father not commending his daughter to keep her vow, staying somewhere too long. That was a little decision that was made. Or how about leaving at nighttime rather than early in the morning? How about that decision? Seems inconsequential. Pressing on further than you should go. Have any of you ever run into trouble doing that? No, one more town. No, a few more miles. No, another hour. No, another half an hour. No, another $100. Pressing on further than you should go. Ooh, acting in the heat of the moment. Never, ever say anything or do anything when you're emotional. That's what this Levite did. Chop, 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 mail. Acting in the heat of the moment is what he did. Anger. How about making a rash commitment? I will never talk to that person. I will never go. I will never make rash commitments. Change any one of those small details. Just one. And our catastrophic moment evaporates. What if she didn't run away? What if the father helped her go back and keep her vow? What if he didn't stay the extra 2 days, 3 days? What if he stopped in the land of foreigners rather than going on to the town where he thought he would be treated better? He wanted to be treated better. What if he just stopped and thought and asked a priest instead of making a decision in the heat of the moment? What if they approached the Lord first and said, what should we do, instead of saying, we'll never? Any one of these little decisions, little things, makes the catastrophic moment go away. And I can almost guarantee you that the annihilation of one of the 12 tribes of Israel was never the plan. How many of you end up where you never planned on being? I never thought I'd be here. I never thought I'd get this bad. I never thought. It wasn't the plan of the wife who ran away. Boy, my actions will bring about the demise of Benjamin. It wasn't the plan of the Levite. It wasn't the plan of the Israelite leaders. Most of our lives are not devastated by sin in a single profound moment. Occasionally, but rarely, rarely, if ever. Most of our lives are devastated by sin one little itty bitty step at a time. Thus, Pastor's Summer 2017 challenge number one. What non-believer in your life can you reach today? Today. Before they're further away tomorrow, before their hearts are further hardened tomorrow. Pastor's Summer 2017 challenge number two. What believers who are ungrounded theologically, biblically in their lives, or attending an ungrounded theologically or biblically church, can you offer the opportunity for being founded, being grounded, being in a family that upholds a culture of peace, rest, and calm, and contentment. And number three, Summer 2017, challenge number three. The sin that you allow is the sin that will enslave. And it's just that simple. What little things over the past 10, 12, 15 weeks that we've been going through this study, what little things keep coming to your mind? Keep coming to your mind. Keep coming to your mind, but you keep dismissing them as small, little, inconsequential things.